Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm John Diaz, editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, and your moderator for tonight's program. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest, Larry Gersten, professor of political science at San Jose State University and author of a new book, Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California. Mr. Gersten has long been regarded as one of the most astute political analysts in the state. He's one of those go-to people when journalists want to add the how and why behind a political or public policy development. In fact, I understand that he was on the phone with a couple of our journalists at the Chronicle just today. And best of all, from the perspective of those of us who are in the news business, his depth of knowledge is accompanied by a talent for breaking down complicated issues in a clear, compelling way. Many of you will recognize Larry from his work as an analyst on NBC 11 television, where he has been a regular contributor since 1980, or from hearing his voice on KCBS radio, to which he has contributed his thoughts and insights since 2002. And of course, I trust that all of you will recognize his byline from the many fine contributions he has made to the San Francisco Chronicle op-ed page. He is the author and co-author of too many books and scholarly journals to list here. So how about if we just stipulate? Larry Gersten knows his stuff and has plenty to say about the state of California. So please welcome Professor Larry Gersten.
I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for the opportunity to be here. And I want to thank John for taking his time tonight to moderate. If you don't know it, John writes a weekly column in the editorial pages where he is the editor, and it's a wonderful column. And it'll keep you in touch with California in ways that you can't possibly imagine. So if you haven't seen it, do look at it. It's well worth your Sunday reading. Let's begin this way. A little audience participation. So listen carefully, and it'll be your turn. All the king's courses and all the king's men. Couldn't put Humpty Dumpty together again. Well, with that quote begins the final chapter of Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California. Yeah, about all the king's horses and all the king's men not putting Humpty together again. After which I ask, rhetorically, or can we? Well, to fix California, if in fact it requires repair, and I would submit it does, we must understand what's wrong with California. It's a lot. Too many people brush off our problems with a quick dismissal of the legislature, the inept legislature, a quick dismissal of a pompous governor, or a quick dismissal of interest groups that have us, you know, with their hands around the neck. Those are all fine things to say, and in one degree or another, I'm sure all are right at one point or another. But the fact of the matter is, we can talk about each of those things. We can have fun, we can vent, but they're only manifestations of a far more serious collection of problems. The symptoms, if you will, of the disease. California is something like an intricate jigsaw puzzle, whose pieces just don't quite come together as well as they should or have in the past. We need to understand the many mysterious, often conflicting and contradictory, if you will, parts. We need to understand why they don't fit together here nearly as well as they do elsewhere or may have in the past. So for the next few minutes, indulge me, please, because we'll discuss how this state, a state with so much potential, has fallen into disrepair. But I promise not to leave you overly depressed, maybe a little depressed. At least I'm going to give you some hope. In fact, there are answers to the questions we're asking. But the looming question is whether we'll embrace these answers or run from them because we're unwilling or unable to do what needs to be done to save the once golden state. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's begin at the beginning. Look, it's obvious. California is a state with great, great potential, but potential gone bad. Look at the people, and we see invention, we see innovation, we see creativity, we see wealth, wealth beyond the wealth of any other state. More billionaires in this state than any other. More millionaires in this state than any other. Also, lots of poverty in this state, much more than most others. We look at the land. It's the best agricultural land in the nation. The best, the very best. We grow more crops here, unique to California, than any other state, by far, by far. And along with that, we have a variety of climates unmatched anywhere. Where else do you go to the ocean in the morning and drive up to the snow by the afternoon? You do that in California. I remember once coming home with my kids, coming back from the mountains of the snow, coming right back down to the bay. Only in California do you do that. It's immense in terms of the variety of climates here. No wonder so many people are here, almost 38 million now. And if you think about its location, it's prime real estate. On the east end of the Pacific Rim, a magnet for promoting all kinds of global trade. The largest ports, L.A., San Pedro, Oakland, the largest ports in the country. A rich confluence, if you will, of cultures, values, ideas, unmatched really in any other state. So how have we gone so wrong when there is so much potential here to do so good? What happened? I would submit there are three answers. One, we don't know how to get along. We need massive group therapy. Second, we don't want to invest in this state, invest in its people, invest in its future. And third, we have a political system that protects the status quo, thereby abandoning most Californians. If you suffered from one of these elements, maybe two of these elements, we might be able to get away with it. Put a patch here, put a patch there. But in fact, all three of these have really come together. And as they have left this state crippled. So let's look at these three problems and then see how we might be able to solve them, if at all. The first, we don't know how to get along. All you have to do is look around. It doesn't have to be in the legislature. It can be a city council. It can be a board of supervisors. We've got the far left on one side. We've got the far right on the other. Historically, we've seen this in California forever. It's just become worse over time. Change agents on the left who want to take everything away and turn it all inside out. Status quo agents on the right who want to keep things the same because it's worked for me. We've got the haves versus the have-nots. The greatest wealth in this state and yet the greatest poverty, all within this same area we call California. We've got various groups pitted against each other, particularly whites versus non-whites. And with that, we see a changing collage. Day by day, we see this state becoming less white, more non-white, and that creates just a collage of problems, anger and whatnot, anti-immigrant sentiment, except, of course, in the fields where we'll allow them to pick whatever and then leave, anti-affirmative action sentiment, which we voted on. We voted on both anti-immigrant bills and anti-affirmative action bills over and over again, either in the legislature or in various ballot issues. So the first problem, yeah, we just don't know how to get along. We're at odds with one another. The second problem, we don't want to invest. I'll start with something very dear to my heart, and I hope to yours, public education. Hey, if you're a have in this state, you've got no problems because the haves live in the wealthy school districts or the haves send their kids to the private schools. The haves pass all the proposed parcel taxes that come to them and then more, and they've got the homeschool clubs and the parent clubs and whatnot collecting money for this and that. It's great. They make sure their kids get the best education. That's the haves. And many of us either know or are part of the haves, and many of us don't even understand what the story is with the have-nots. But let me tell you, there are plenty of them, so much more than we ever appreciate or understand. The have-nots toil in schools in California that collectively leave this state, and it's kind of shocking to a lot of us, ranking 48th in per capita funding. 48th in per capita funding, per student funding. Last I saw, there were only 50 states. So you get an idea who we're battling with for the bottom spots. Mississippi, Louisiana. Oh, that's good. Okay? That's where we are in funding for public education. Okay? The foundation for any future adult, public education. We have the largest class sizes in the nation. Yes, folks, we rank number one there. The largest class sizes per capita, students to teacher, in the nation. And if that isn't bad enough, we are among the states with the fewest school days. Only four states have fewer school days and hours than California. Well, let's think about that. Largest number of students per teacher, ranked near the bottom in spending, have the shortest school days. Do we expect these kids to emerge as rocket scientists? Not likely. Not likely. So what's the consequences of all this? Things that you and I pay for all of our lives. We may not think about it, but we're paying for it. Dropout rates. High dropout rates. Around 25% from the ninth grade on. You know, you're not going to see one out of four of these kids graduate, get a diploma, which is not exactly opening the doors to a CEO's life. Not even getting a diploma. Okay? And we know that non-whites have much higher dropout rates than whites. We see this state lagging badly in test scores, badly in high school graduation. If we look very recently, this came out from an organization called NAEP, National Association for Education Progress, a nonprofit. This is California we're talking about. This is the once golden, now not so golden state. Basic math proficiency, just proficiency, right? The kind of thing where you take off your shoes to count, 2 2's 4, that kind of thing. Basic math proficiency for the fourth grade, we rank 44th. For the eighth grade, 46th, going downhill fast, not much where to go. Basic reading proficiency for the fourth grade, 47th. For the eighth grade, 50th. Dead last. We can't read. We can't add. No wonder we don't have any engineers. This is a problem. This is a serious problem. The irony is, of course, we'd rather pay $50,000 a year annually for prisoners than spend an additional $4,000 or $5,000 per capita for students, preparing them for the next generation. There's something warped with the values here. There's no question in my mind. And that also puts companies in a bind, by the way, because they're waiting for all these good employees, these skilled employees. They've got jobs waiting for these employees, but there are no employees to come, or not nearly enough. And so they either bring in H-1B workers, you know about all that, or they send the jobs offshore for the skilled workers who are there. Not a good choice, one way or the other. Of course, they don't mind doing that because when they send those employees offshore, they park enormous profits there, thus reducing their state obligation in the process. Okay? We might look at something like transportation and land use. Well, once again, we're looking at number 50, 50th in per capita spending on transportation. Dead last. That's why it costs twice as much to maintain a car on the road in California as it does nationally. We're paying for it. We're just not paying in taxes. We're paying the repair shop instead. This is combined, of course, with everyone wanting his or her detached home as far away as possible from everyone else, and that's part of our aversion to planning. We don't do planning very well in California. We want our piece of the real estate. We'll stay far away. We'll be on congested roads. I don't want to tell you how long it took me to get here from Los Gatos today, except I left yesterday. Okay? Leave it at that. It's a spread-out society that also increases infrastructure costs in every way, from moving electricity to moving people. Another way you might also want to look at something like water, always in short supply in a state like California, where 75% of the water is north of the Tehachapis and 75% of the population is south. You got that. Okay? That's a problem in itself. Well, water, as scarce as it is, terribly misused by agriculture. Why? Because we grow water-intensive crops. What are we thinking? There are all kinds of other crops you can grow in an arid state like ours, but no, we have to grow the crops that take up the most water. Doesn't make sense. The environmentalists prize fish over people. Well, I guess you can flip a coin over that one. They oppose new dams. The farmers, on the other hand, prize water over everything and anything and anyone else. There's a conflict, yet one of many in California. Repeatedly, we are unwilling to tax ourselves to address our many problems. And that takes us to the third issue. We have a broken political system, and that is not doing us any good. I don't get to this in the book until I discuss all these other problems, because hopefully the political system might address these problems, yet it hasn't. To which I suggest we have what I call the seven deadly sins of California. Now, I know someone's about to say, why so few? I'm just trying to stay with the major points. The seven deadly sins of California. Number one, term limits. By the way, it's my intention to tick off everyone in this room by the time I'm through, so just give me another few minutes. Number one, term limits. We call ourselves a democracy, yet we don't trust people as to how long we want to keep somebody in office. For that matter, do we have to let them go the full terms before we throw them out? Well, he's got one more term in the assembly. I'll wait. If someone's a jerk, he should be thrown out. Likewise, if somebody does well, why would we want to take that great talent and artificially remove somebody from office? Do we not trust people to make decisions? Number one, term limits. Number two, what I call out-of-control direct democracy. You need to be a PhD in English to understand how initiatives are written. Go get past the title, which is confusing enough, and try to read the summary. I'm lost by the second section, the second sentence, and this is my business. There's so many negatives, this will not do what another does, this, that, no way. What? Can't they just say words without having 14 negatives in the same sentence? You know, one cancels out the other, what do I do next? It's crazy. The initiatives are out of control. They count on an uneducated and uninformed public, which we tend to be. And invariably, they are tools of special interest. Why are they tools of special interest? Although they were created to control special interests, mostly the railroad, Southern Pacific Railroad. They're tools because to get initiative on the ballot, you need 400,000 plus signatures if it's a statute. You need 800,000 plus if it's a constitutional amendment. Not many of us know that many friends, even on Facebook. So what you have to do is get those signatures at the mall or someplace like that. And you see somebody at the mall say, hey, would you like to sign this thing? What a nice, upstanding citizen. That person's getting paid $2, $3, $4, sometimes as many as $8 or $9 per valid signature. Okay? Ah, yeah, they walk away at the end of the weekend with a car. Okay? That's because special interests can go ahead and spend the $2 to $3 million it takes to qualify issues for the ballot. So direct democracy in this state, most of us know that as the initiative, in some cases the referendum, is out of control. Number three, terribly poor revenue sources. We have the most cockamamie tax system that any state could ever not wish for. Trust me. We have a disproportionate dependence on the income tax, about 58% of all the general fund money comes from one tax source, the progressive income tax. And it really hurts people, especially those in the higher income brackets. All kinds of other tax sources are left on the table, whether they're sin taxes, whether they're taxes for minerals, whether they're exemptions, R&D exemptions, or other types of exemptions given to various types of companies and whatnot. And locally, same deal. Not enough ability to generate local funds. We tie local government's hands with a series of initiatives. You can't collect here, you can't collect there, you need a two-thirds vote there, whatnot. Local governments, which no longer have the ability to collect, thanks to things like Prop 13, don't have ways to get money back. And even they give basic benefits and basic breaks, as we've seen in San Francisco with what they're doing with tech companies locating in a certain portion of the city. Don't worry, we'll get it back one way or another. No, they're not getting it. They're not getting it. Before that's over, that's going to be one ugly system and mess. Number four, we have major obstacles when it comes to passing the budget, particularly the state budget. There is this rule, and maybe some of you don't even know about it. It's called the absolute two-thirds requirement. What? Am I saying absolute to be impressive? No, no, no. There's a meaning to absolute. There are 80 members in the assembly. There are 40 members in the state senate. Okay, 54 are 2/3 of the assembly. 27 are 2/3 of the state senate. Okay, well, you say 2/3. So what? Absolute means it must have at least 54 votes. 27 votes in the senate. So some guys come in the next morning hungover from a great party that a lobbyist threw, and a vote on something is 53-0 and 26-0, it fails. It fails if it is a tax-related measure, overturning the governor's veto, or passing what we call an urgency measure, something that takes place right up upon his signature instead of the next January. Absolute two-thirds, you hardly ever get absolute two-thirds, which, of course, gives more power to status quo interest. Just leave things the way we are because we like it. Okay. Number five, designated spending. We think about the state budget as this massive amount of money. And by the way, it is very, very small compared to the populations of other big states. It's quite small. And we say, we've got all this money to throw around. 70% of the state's budget has been spent before a vote. 40% of the state budget goes through goes for K through 12 education. Okay, that is law. Okay, a certain percentage of the vote goes for mental health. That is law that the voters have passed. Money gets set aside for transportation. That is law. So in other words, you cannot take this money and say, how are we going to carve this up this year, given the state's problems? You have to spend so much here, so much there, so much everywhere. Well, people like that. That's a good idea because it tells us where the money's going. On the other hand, you have no flexibility. And even this new proposition on the ballot, again, I'm going to make a few enemies in this one, Prop 29. Okay, Prop 29, that's the one in come June that's going to add $1 per pack to the price of cigarettes. I'll tell you my own bias. If it were up to me, I'd add $5 a pack to the price of cigarettes. Okay, maybe $5 a cigarette in each pack. I like that better. Okay? Solve a lot of problems. That sounds great. I like that. I like that a lot. At the same time, the money in Prop 29 is set aside for cancer research. What if I want to research something else? Doesn't matter. It's cancer research. What if I have a problem with the state highway system collapsing? I need to spend money there. Well, you're going to have to do it after you get healed from cancer. Okay? It's got to be cancer research. That's it. That's the kind of thing that we do. And so you get a guy like me, you say, geez, I just can't stand the idea of the smoking stuff. I don't like it. It's terrible. It's bad for you. It hurts people. It's secondary smoke, blah, blah, blah. But then again, it's only for cancer research, and we have a $20 billion a year structural deficit in this state. Maybe we should take some of it for that. Can't do it. That's the problem. That's the problem we have with most of these initiatives, okay? The money is set aside for X, Y, or Z. Number six, overlapping local governments. Oh, I know. We all have our favorite little city council. We all have our favorite little school district. We all have our favorite little police force where we know this person forever. Well, you know what? Those days where we were separated by miles and went from A to B on horseback, right? Those days are over. The boundaries of one city collide and collapse and run into the boundaries of another city. Santa Clara County, where I come from, okay, has 34 school districts. What? 34 superintendents. Some ungodly number of deputy superintendents. Where I live in Los Gatos, a pretty nice, affluent place. There's a town next door called Campbell, almost as affluent. One day a few years ago, the trustees from the Campbell School District, high school district, walked into the trustees from the Los Gatos School District. Okay, we got an idea. You're about the same size as we are. You know, if we merge our school districts, we'll have one superintendent instead of two. Boom, a couple $100,000 freed there. We'll have one deputy superintendent instead of two or three, more money. We'll be able to do all kinds of things for our kids that we haven't been able to do. Maybe even open up libraries. There's a concept. Okay? All kinds of other things. What do you say we merge? The guys from Los Gatos School District look at them. Us? We merge with you Campbellians? Who let you in? Where are your papers? This is it. I mean, this is crazy, okay? We do this again and again. School district, not my school district, best school district. I don't want anybody to merge with it because God knows what diseases they'll bring. Well, guess what? We pay a lot of money for those individual school districts, for those individual police districts, for those individual special districts. We have 1,000 school districts in this state. We have another 5,000 special districts in the states of various kinds. Why? They should be merged. The city of Whittier, California has, in Southern California, let's blame them for something, they have 80,000 people in that city. Four school districts. Okay? Why? Think of all, we talk about bureaucracy. People point the finger at the federal government. People point the finger, I won't say which one, at the state government. If you want to point fingers and you want to talk about bureaucratic waste, I hate to tell you this, but I'm going to be the first maybe, it's local government. That's where you have the most waste. There's no question about it. And finally, unnecessary offices. Oh, my gosh. You look at something like the executive branch, okay? Just think of this one example. We have a state controller. We have a state treasurer. We have a board of equalization. These are all individually elected office holders, okay? Now, you got to follow the bouncing ball in this one, okay? Because the controller is the guy who collects the money and ultimately writes the checks. The treasurer is the guy who invests the money that was collected by the controller before he writes the checks. The board of equalization is the five-member group, one of whom is the controller, who oversees all the tax policy. Of course, when you send your money into California, you don't send it to any of them. You send it to the franchise tax board. Okay? Why do we have all these things? There's no reason to have all these things. Why do we have a Fair Political Practices Commission and a Secretary of State when they both do the same thing in most cases? So much of the data keeping. It doesn't make sense. Nobody takes a look at what we have. All we do is pile on offices one after another, and everyone says, great idea, more accountability. No. More confusion. That's what we have in this golden state. Not to mention the 300 commissions and boards, some of which pay their office holders $125,000, $130,000 a year for a meeting 2 days a month. I want that job. Okay? What's the consequences? Well, I can tell you a lot of consequences, but there are three big ones that come out here. Number one, quality jobs exiting the state. Gone. We don't have anybody to do the jobs. No one trained. Number two, an uncompetitive next generation because we're not teaching them, because nobody wants to pay to get them taught. And that's because, that's why I need to go back to school. And finally, the other factor being an infrastructure in near total disrepair. What are we going to do about this? I'm not sending you out here totally depressed, I promise. Here's what I suggest. Number one, we've got to recalibrate our taxing and spending. I mentioned earlier that we've got a minimum $20 billion structural deficit. Every year, when we're about to start the fiscal year, we're $20 billion short. You don't take this up by collecting money at the corner. $20 billion short. We've got to adjust Prop 13. I know that's another one. Oh, I know. We've got to adjust Prop 13 in a way where homeowners are protected, but businesses pay their fair share. There's something not right about HP being at the same site since 1978 and not having its property taxes go up. That doesn't sound right to me. Okay, we've seen a whole shift there. We've got to do things like spread out the sales tax. Right now, we collect sales taxes only on 40% of all the things that could be taxed. We've got to increase sin taxes. There's something wrong when we haven't increased the beer, wine taxes, and hard liquor taxes since 1992. There's something wrong. We ought to do it at least once a century, like it or not. We need to tax those industries that haven't been taxed. Think about things like oil. We are the only one of 23 oil-producing states that does not tax oil coming out of the ground. There's something wrong when we're not doing it, and Alaska and Texas are. Okay? That's $1 billion a year right there, but with a minor tax. They're laughing at us all the way. We've got to reconsider the tax loopholes, the exemptions, billions of dollars a year. and we've got to enable local governments to raise revenues. As far as spending goes, we've got to bring public education up to speed fast. We've got to find a way to keep kids in school. We've got to find ways to retrain them, I should say train them, and get them ready to move on in the 21st century. We've got to repair our infrastructure to prepare to prevent real disaster, roads, water system, power grid, high-speed rail. Yeah, because that's the same thing as 12 highway lanes that not only cost a lot to create, but an awful lot to maintain. We've got to make the political process workable. Majority votes for taxes, for crying out loud. Get rid of those term limits. Increase the threshold for qualifying initiatives. Make it hard for initiative. Make somebody really pay. Eliminate duplicative offices. Consolidate districts and services. Make state and local elections at the same time. Why do some state local localities have elections in May of an odd-numbered year? Why? That makes no sense. L.A. is going to have its mayor's race next year. The primary is going to be in March. 6 people will turn out. Okay? There's nothing else to go for. It's crazy. But we've done it. We've done it again and again. Some of these things are so simple, yet we just take the tried and, I would say, not-so-true path. We've got to help those who need help the most. We need to let people know what's going on and invite them into the process. We've got to make our public schools truly integrated, and they are not. We've got to make second language mandatory, you know, because it will break down barriers and help our kids prepare for the 21st century. All these changes can't be made at once. Of course not. But the sooner we begin, the sooner we move in the right direction. Who will pay for all these changes? Everyone. Some more, some less. We have been on a gravy train, a free ride now for decades. But we'll get plenty back in return. I got to tell you, I grew up in California. I grew up in the 50s and 60s. This state had the best schools. This state had the best water system, a big, huge, massive water system, a water system bond issue that was passed one year in the late 50s that was the size of the state budget. This state had the best transportation system and the best higher education system, all these things, free higher education. When I went to Cal in 1966, I transferred there. My tuition was $55 a quarter. And we were moaning about that. Imagine, okay? It's crazy. These things will cost us, but you know what? We will benefit. And if we want to make the Golden State truly golden again, if we want California to survive, if we want the next generation to be competitive, in my book, we have no choice. So I hope you'll take some of that to heart and think about that the next time you talk about making California golden again.
Thank you very much, Larry Gersten. A reminder to our radio audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Larry Gersten, professor of political science at San Jose State University, and he's discussing his new book, Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California. I'm John Diaz, the editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. Larry, I'm going to try and bring the audience down a little bit out of its depression and see if we can find more causes for hope. It's certainly a grim portrait that you painted. The first of your deadly sins was term limits. There is a measure for those who are not aware of this in the audience on the June 5th ballot, Proposition 28, that will change term limits where members can serve a longer period of time in a single house. Does that solve your, or at least address your concern?
No, it doesn't address it. It certainly, let's say it, if on a scale of 1 to 10, I call term limits a 0, this makes it to 1. Okay? And here's why. Look, what you get in the legislature over time is expertise. And so, granted, by changing the law so that you're not stuck to a limit of 6 years in the assembly and 8 years in the Senate, and now it's only 12 years wherever, sure, you allow that person to accrue a bit more expertise, but you're still tossing that person out. You know, why would anybody want to throw somebody out of a position where the person gains expertise and knowledge as they work their way through it. And it just befuddles me. I think people don't really understand how hard legislators work. I mean, most of them. Are there some bad ones? Of course. But most of them, it's a tough road.
The biggest problem with term limits right now is in the state assembly, is it not, with a six-year term limit? We have the Speaker of the Assembly right now was elected as a freshman, his first two-year term. You have committee chairs coming in early. Isn't that really the biggest source of the problem?
Absolutely. You've got to prepare ahead of time. And, at the risk of offending anybody who's left, I haven't offended yet. John Perez, maybe a heck of a nice guy, may have been a great labor organizer, but he's had his hands full as an early elected leader speaker. And Daryl Steinberg, who happens to be the Senate President Pro Tem, had the advantages of 6 years of the Assembly. So he, uncharacteristically, has really taken control of the legislature. And you need somebody to herd these cats. And it's very hard, and you don't see a Daryl Steinberg coming very often.
You talked about initiative reform. One of the points you made in your book was in the entire decade of the 1960s, there were something like 10 measures on the ballot. And we've had a number of elections in recent years where there's been 10 state measures on the ballot in a single election.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, of course, as this state has grown and as more and more interests have understood the process, the way to get things that they want, they have turned to the initiative process either to use it favorably or, for that matter, to kill something. Prop 29, as I mentioned earlier, I've got some mixed feelings about. But I guarantee you, before it's over, our friends in the tobacco industry will spend upwards of $70 million to defeat it. They spent $65 million in 2006, and by the time we were through, we were convinced that anybody who voted for that proposition, 86 it was called, was obviously a communist or something. Money flows here in this state with special interests, and they use it both ways. So it's unfortunate that as they have realized this is a way to get things done or to keep things done, they have taken advantage of it.
You make a really good point about how easy it is to get an initiative on the ballot if you have enough money and the lack of standards in terms of the petition gathering process. In fact, the Center for Governmental Studies in Los Angeles took a look a few years ago at what people who were gathering signatures were telling people, and it turns out the number one most effective pitch to get somebody to sign a petition outside a grocery store was, "It's my birthday. Will you sign my petition?" Larry, you make the point that it needs to be harder to get things on the ballot, and certainly a lot of us agree with this. At the same time, to have direct democracy work, by making it harder for the special interests, you're also making it harder for the true grassroots movement. We haven't seen many of those in recent years. But how do you balance that so that we still have that check on special interests?
Well, it's a trade-off, John. There's no question about it. I mean, there are very few times when you have truly a grassroots movement anymore. So I don't think we're going to lose a lot of those. What I'd really like to do, and I write about this, is find ways to help the legislature be more accountable. You get rid of term limits, that's part of it. But also, if we're going to put a ballot measure before the voters, give the legislature 90 days ahead of time to work on it. Let them say, okay, look, this is going to go to the voters unless you address this one way or another. And then we help the legislature do its job. As it is, many legislators, especially with a hot-button issue, say, wow, I don't want to tackle that one, immigration reform, or I don't want to tackle this question about income taxes or whatever. I'll let the people decide. And they just back out. I think it's more important for me to see a representative democracy than a direct democracy. And if I had to choose for one or the other, that's the way I would go.
Let's go to some audience questions and see if we can get the audience back in a depressed mood with this question. What if Governor Brown's tax measures don't pass in November, then what?
Boy, my talk seems happy compared to that. we're going to be in a world of hurt. For one thing, there's a lot of stuff that people don't really get right now that hasn't been talked about. The state controller gives out a report every month, and, I'm one of these geeks that reads that report. And, in fact, we're going to end this fiscal year about $12 to $15 billion in the hole. despite everything. And that's because we've wound up spending more money than we anticipated, and we've not collected as much. And so they talk about a $7 or $8 billion deficit beginning July 1st. Add to that the 12 or 15, whatever it is, billion-dollar deficit we're ending. Now you got that $20 billion. Imagine, okay? Now, if this thing passes, we'll collect maybe $7 or $8 billion for 5 years, which will only kind of cut into some of that. Most of the money, all of it really, goes to one form of education or another. And you know where we are with that. If it doesn't pass, you can add another $7 or $8 billion to what's already a disaster. The school year right now for most districts is now 170. It used to be between 180 and 190. For some now it's 165. It'll go down to 150, something like that. Get ready for long summers. Yeah, you bet.
Larry, as we well know, unlike in Washington where they can run deficits, California constitutionally is required to have a balanced budget. How can you say we have a state deficit? What are they doing with smoke and mirrors up there in Sacramento?
We're borrowing money. We're doing a lot of what we call deferred maintenance. We're taking money from funds that it's supposed to be earmarked for, and in some cases, borderline illegally, using it for the wrong thing. In a lot of cases, what we're doing is we're trying to catch up. We owe you. Okay, now we'll pay you. Now we owe you. And so there's some of that going on, a lot of it. And you can get away with it for a while, but sooner or later, we're going to collapse. We have, you may know, the lowest bond rating of all 50 states. Oh, it's cataclysmic, this stuff. And most of us just would rather keep our heads in the sand. But that all catches up, too, in our interest.
But the audience should be glad to know. A few weeks ago, Mississippi passed us, so we're now number 49.
Yeah, feeling better.
Couple questions about taxes from the audience. One is, do you think taxing the sale of marijuana can help these problems? How come the students are laughing?
Well, that's all right, let me give you a serious answer. Sure, it could help. You've got a series of problems there in terms of regulation. Right now, local areas, one to another, regulate it differently. There's no real handle on this whole thing. You're talking about bringing in perhaps between $100 and $200 million a year. That's going to help. We are going to get some help with internet taxation in California. That is going to be a new source of taxation. That'll bring us maybe $700 million to $1 billion, too, depending upon how it works. There are some things, but marijuana basically is not going to help the revenue system. It may help people feel good.
Another audience question. Will taxing California oil companies, as you suggested, increase the cost of gasoline?
It could, but not by much. You're talking about a penny or two a gallon. It's nothing to speak of. And we're talking about, you realize that in the last, what is it now? I'm going by memory, which is always suspect. The top five oil-producing companies in the last, well, I'm not going to give you the data because I don't remember it, but I mean they're making obscene profits, obscene profits. I'm sorry, Chevron and San Ramon, for any of you here from there. But I mean really obscene profits. They can afford a tax increase easily. And the all the other oil-producing states have it.
We had several questions about public employee pensions, and specifically a question here of the grip that public employees unions have on the state, counties, and municipalities. How can we possibly fund these commitments? And there is certainly in Sacramento a great deal of influence.
Okay, now you know I'm a public employee. Okay, I'm stating it right now. I think the problem we have here is twofold. Number one, these pensions, especially at the local level, were negotiated. They were negotiated. I mean, it's not as if anybody had a gun to the heads of local government. So they made these decisions, maybe unwisely, and so you've got to find a way to get out of it, you know, without basically going back on your word. That's number one. Number two, if you're thinking about pension reform, the only way to do it, in my judgment, is to think about future employees, not present or past employees, because that deal was made. And, you know, there's something about a contract. Number three, we need to separate the kinds of pensions that someone who makes $400,000 a year as a chief of police or a city administrative officer and then walks off with that pension and 5 years later is collecting another pension. That's something I've seen about that. Versus the secretary or the administrative assistant who spent 35, 40 years and walks away with a pension of $20,000. We can't lump these things together.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Larry Gersten, professor of political science at San Jose State University, who is discussing his book, Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California. I'm John Diaz from the San Francisco Chronicle. Larry, a follow-up on the issue of public employee pensions. A lot of this started in Sacramento around the turn of the century when California was having some really flush times and was running big surpluses, and Gray Davis and others gave some fairly generous increases, and then that led to local governments, particularly with law enforcement, offering those pensions so they could stay competitive. How do we are in such a boom or bust cycle in this state. How do we get out of that? Because it seems like every time there's another upturn, we forget the lessons of the past.
We've got to come up with a revenue collection system that assures we're not counting on any one source too much. I love the progressive income tax. I believe in that. But when it accounts for 58% of your revenue, well, when things go great, fine. You know, Facebook's going to go public. The state has already estimated that over the next 3 years, it will gain an extra $2.5 billion from this company going public. Well, great. Well, what happens when it goes the other way? You know, the revenues go down because we're counting on income taxes for 58%. Remember I said earlier, I think we all have to pay here. Even taking the sales tax and flattening it out more to areas that we don't normally pay, attorneys, dry cleaners, and whatnot. We also need to stop giving all of these incredible deductions to businesses and corporations, which on the one hand can't wait to take their profits and their jobs someplace else, but on the other hand don't want to pay their share. I mean, in the book we talk about how their share of the revenue stream has gone down dramatically in the last 20 years. We have to redistribute in ways that everybody pays their share.
And what do you think the possibilities are, Larry, of real meaningful tax reform? Because certainly there are a lot of not only special interests but popular sentiment against paying more taxes.
You know, I think what we have to realize, people need to get to the point where they realize just how much we are suffering, our children are suffering, and in my case, my little grandchild is suffering from our concern with saving every dollar. California is a fairly wealthy state. Income-wise, we are 10th highest in the nation. In terms of all the taxes we collect, all of them, okay, income, sales, corporate, and property, we rank like 18th or 19th. So it's not as if we're overtaxed considering our income. We have to come to terms with that. And if we want to live in this place, which was once paradise, and make it paradise again, we've got to pay.
Larry, another audience question. What do you think could be done about the high number of lobbyists in Sacramento and the influence that they hold?
Well, that's a toughie because, you know, if it's my group, it's a public interest group. If it's your group, it's a special interest group because only my people are good. I mean, you know, we all have those who represent us, whether it's the Automobile Club or whether it's a teacher's union or whether it's a chamber of commerce or something, and they all do some good. But in the end, if we give legislators the power to say no, and the interest groups know they're going to be there for a long time, I think that's part of the answer. There is no one easy answer. I think the other thing is to take money that comes in to the political system and make it transparent. And we do a terrible job at that.
We're going to be getting to live audience questions in a moment. So if you could start lining up at the microphone, and particularly if some of you students are getting extra credit for asking a question, definitely muscle your way into line now. Larry, in terms of following up on the question of influence, we had a couple questions about one of the few discretionary areas that competes with particularly higher education is corrections. Can you speak about the influence of prison guards and how that may have distorted public policy in the last 10, 12, 15 years?
Well, there's no doubt about it that union is perhaps the most successful of all. They are incredibly highly paid. They have incredible benefits. They work overtime. I mean, these people do very well. Now, I'm not going to tell you that I want their job, okay? It's a tough job. There's no question about it. And it's a deal that Gray Davis made, and quite frankly, I think he gave them at one point like a 38% raise. Well, that's just too much. Look, people, and Davis, I might add, paid the price. Maybe he shouldn't have for all the reasons he did, but he paid the ultimate price. Look, government is not perfect. It just isn't. And sometimes we expect that everything is going to work the way we think it should, and we have to be vigilant. Part of our problem is that we, the voters, have taken our eye off the ball. We haven't taken ownership of the state. We've given it to others to do things and not really thought twice about it. And when someone makes kind of a deal that Gray Davis did with the unions and the prisons, or the deal, quite frankly, that he and Arnold Schwarzenegger made with the tribes over gambling, in both cases, you know, they gave away all kinds of stuff and they got contributions back. We need to understand that. We need to be punitive in terms of turning them out if, in fact, they have violated our trust.
Let's go to a live audience question. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Mark Moyser. I'm actually running for state senate in this area, and I've really enjoyed your conversation. We could talk for hours, but the one thing that interested me the most was your talk about eliminating duplicate local government agencies, and I was wondering, how do we go about doing that? Do you think that's something at a state level, or do you think that's something we have to do individually as counties?
Well, first of all, it happens at the state level. I mentioned, yeah, just for example, that the offices of Comptroller, Treasurer, Board of Equalization, and Franchise Tax Board, that's a maze if you ever saw one. It also happens with the Secretary of State and the Fair Political Practices Commission. It also happens with a half a dozen health agencies inside the executive branch. I mean, believe me, we can go on forever. But at the local level, guess what? We are seeing signs, the earliest signs that people are getting it. And of all the places, San Mateo County has done more of this than anybody else. They've seen their budgets go down terribly for all kinds of reasons. And in many cases, the police forces have been turned out, and the city, Half Moon Bay, for example, has gone with the sheriff's department. We've seen other cities in San Mateo County that have merged fire departments. It's doable. It's very doable, and there are other cities and counties that are beginning to show this as well. People have a hard time giving up what they think is theirs. And what I would say in turn is, for whatever you're giving up to make the theirs a little larger, there's so much more money to do what we need to do, and we just don't have it. Now, I know it's unpopular. You know, I'm not going to make a lot of friends when I walk into the Santa Clara County Board of Supervisors and start talking about this. But, you know, that's not my job. My job is just to tell it.
I want to see some of the students get in line for questions. A lot of these issues that Larry is talking about here tonight are really going to affect you and your future, and here's your chance. Yes.
Okay. Well, as I was listening to your talk, I agree with certain of your points, and then I disagree with certain others. But one of them just blew my mind. On the one hand, you talk about the structural deficit that the state has, and then you're in favor of this high-speed train system that's going to be a hole in our pockets for centuries, because they always understate the costs. It's got to be subsidized. There's no indication that people are going to be riding from Fresno to Merced or wherever it's going to start. So I don't understand that point at all.
You don't think they'll make a lot of money on Chowchilla to Bakersfield?
Whatever it is.
Wow. Look, this is a hard one for me. I'm going to tell you that right now. This is a hard one. I've gone back and forth on this one. But I think in the end, on balance, if we're talking about repairing the infrastructure in this state, nothing is more important than transportation, because there's so many of us going so many places, and along the way, we're doing all kinds of things that many of us don't think about. We're polluting the environment. We're causing health problems. We're using up vast amounts of petroleum. All these things. We only think about the train. Well, here's another way of looking at it. What's it going to cost to keep all those cars on the road? What's it going to cost for those 12 lanes? What's it going to cost for the massive tie-ups at the airports and whatnot because we don't make these changes? There's a massive trade-off that most of us don't think about. Will it cost a lot of money? Yes. You're absolutely right. Do we have to find a way to pay for it? In my mind, the answer is yes. And worst of all, I'm no fool, I don't think. I don't think we can count on the federal government. We're going to have to dip into our pockets. We're going to have to make some sacrifice. And you know what? Californians just aren't good at that. Other states are. See what they're paying for public education in Massachusetts, in New York, in Connecticut. See what their property taxes are like through the roof. If you saw it over there, you'd probably throw up. But I'll tell you something. They're making the sacrifices, and we just aren't. And I think we have to think about that in terms of the high-speed rail, too. Thank you, though, for bothering to disagree. I appreciate it. I really think it's important to provoke people to think about this stuff. Yes. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Andrew McMaster. I'm a junior at Bishop O'Dowd High School in Oakland. And I guess looking into my future personally, I'm a California native, born and raised in Oakland. I've lived here my whole life. I can see myself living here my whole life. So I guess my question is more about the, or can they? What sectors do you see California having the most growth in the next few decades? And what should I major in college?
is it Andrew? Is that the name? Andrew, the second question in some ways for me is easier than the first. It's the question I've told my students for 38 years. It's a question I've told my three children. And the answer I've given to all of them is three words. Follow your passion. Do what you like and you will do well. I'm not sure where you're going to do it. I'm not sure if you're going to make enough money to buy your first house by the time you're 30. But do what you want, and you will be a fulfilled person. And it so pains me when I see parents saying, my kid should do this because he or she will do well. Kid doesn't want anything to do with it. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, yeah, there are jobs here. There are jobs, and we haven't found a way yet to match the jobs okay, with the people. Now, by the way, this is a problem all over the United States, but it seems to be even more so here. One of the areas where we're seeing California really take off is in green energy, green technology. I mean, you know, all these things happening with solar and other forms of energy. Lots of things happen good out of this. We're less dependent on fossil fuel. The environment is less to clean up. And there are jobs for people who become solar techs, for example, who build these things as well as install them. That's part of it. There are all these industries that go along with it. I think that's an area we need to think about. Of course, we're doing very well in the sciences and engineering. These companies cannot get enough of engineers. They cannot. So I think there's plenty of opportunity there. There are lots of areas where we need to think about it, but so far we haven't found ways to train people and educate them commensurate with what our needs are, and I'm hoping we get there. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Andrew. And if your teacher doesn't give you extra credit for asking that question, tell them we are going to be editorializing against them in the Chronicle day after day. Yes, welcome.
Hello. My question has to do with the issue of term limits, and that has to do a lot with the power of incumbency. And I see no sense in extending term limits if there's not something done about campaign financing reform, which there was an issue on this. And I wish you would address that, because once somebody's elected in this state, if, as in the example of federal officials, they're elected over and over and over, and many people have no chance against the monolith of incumbency.
Well, you might want to ask Bob Bennett about that in Utah, who was turned out by his own party. I think we can turn people out if we take ownership, and I think that's the problem. I think we don't take ownership. Most of us don't pay attention, and then we get upset and we say the system's rigged or the incumbent's protected. I don't buy that. If we take ownership, if we get upset about what's going on, we act. And people need to remember that the system depends upon them and their vigilance. Now, as far as money goes, look. There is no way to control money in politics. It's impossible. There's no law that's ever been passed that, in one way or another, makes sure that money is limited to X, Y, or Z. And of course, with the Citizens United case by the Supreme Court, like it or not, now they're just throwing money. I think what we need to do is be very transparent. Okay, and it happens two ways. I think what we need to do is, first of all, make sure that we account for the money coming in and let people know. On user-friendly websites, and if you've ever been on either the FPPC's or the Secretary of State's website, it's a disaster, both of them. They're awful. I'm convinced they're there to make me go away, you know, and that's just not right. And they can be more transparent. We need to make them more transparent. We need to produce results. This last month, here's the money that came in and from whom. We need to know this. And you and I need to read about this. We need to understand who's paying what to try to buy a vote. That's our job to do that. That's why we have to take ownership, okay? I think that's a good deal of it. The other thing is that, I forgot, but there's another one. I'll try to remember.
Larry, it might be worth noting there are a couple of voter-approved reforms that are going to change the way elections are covered this year that it's going to be interesting. I'll be like to hear your analysis on both redistricting. We used to have the case where the politicians would choose their own district. Now it was independently done. The top two primary, instead of a Republican and Democrat, the top two finishers. How do you think that's going to play out this year?
Look, let me say one thing first. I remember the other thing. The other thing was, I think it was Marc Saulnier. He's from not so far from here, right?
Yeah.
Is he here tonight? Is he going to hit me? Okay, he introduced a bill recently, and I wrote about it. I blog about it at NBC. Go to Prop Zero, NBCBayArea.com, Prop Zero, a little plug, and you'll see my blog along with the blogs of some pretty nice people, pretty sharp people. We're on all the time. And anyway, he had a bill recently where he wanted to make sure, I like the idea, where he said, anyone contributing over X amount of money to or against a ballot proposition, that should be stated on the voting guide. I like that. The only problem I had, he got mad at me, everybody does, the only problem I had was there was too long of a waiting period. It was like 90 days out. Well, you know how much money can come in, you know, in the last 90 days, the last 60 or 30? But I like the idea of making sure that when we vote for something, on 29, oh, $25 million came from Philip Morris to defeat that? That's nice to know. Duh, light bulb goes on. So that was the other thing I wanted to tell you. Look, we have passed two major changes, which to me gets back to the will of the voters. It gets back to the will of the voters. We can do things. The first redistricting, we had seven attempts on the ballot to pass redistricting, to take it away from the legislature and put it into the hands of an independent district redistricting commission. Seven times it was defeated. The eighth time the voters said, enough. Hey, we should pat ourselves on the back for that, okay? And I've taken a look at the new districts, and by golly, I think they're incredibly improved over the last ones, you know, which look like Rorschach tests, you know. They're crazy. So that's number one. As far as top two goes, the top two primary system, for those of you who don't know, what it says is that the top two people who get the most votes for state senate, assembly, Congress, they will face off against each other in November. Okay? Well, a couple of things about that. Number one, if John and I are running against each other, and there are three or four other people, I get 85% of the vote, he gets 10, and the others split the other 5. Remember what I said about math, I hope I'm okay. Okay? He and I are going to run against each other again in November because that's what it says. That's what top two says. So in other words, in the old days, if you got a majority vote, you're done. So look what we're doing to the cost of campaigns. We're increasing them. We've got a couple of doozy campaigns, one where I live in the South Bay, Jim Bell and Joe Cotto, raising oodles of money. They're the only Democrats running. They're going to face each other again. You might have heard of the congressional campaign. Same thing down south, Howard Berman. And his opponent, Sherman, they've raised $8-9 million for the first go round. Again, so top two, I think, was a mistake. It was ill conceived. I also think it weakens third parties, and even though, because they got no chance, you know, the Libertarian Party or the Socialist Party or the Feel Good Party, whatever. I'm not a big believer in third parties, but I think they should have their shot. So I'm not too happy with that.
We've got time for one more question.
My name is Earl Rupp from Pleasant Hill, and I have a comment question on your remark about public employee pensions being negotiated. Isn't it a case that they're really not negotiated? The public employee unions pour tons of money into the election. And then it's almost impossible for a candidate to win who's not supported by them. Then when it comes time to negotiate, it's more like negotiating. It's not negotiating with a third party. It's negotiating with someone that you've hired. Could you comment on that?
I think there are times when unions pour a lot of money into elections. I think there are times when the Chamber of Commerce or other organizations pours just as much. Where I am in Santa Clara County, for example, the voters recently passed an initiative that allows the city to reduce pensions, and the city council is on the verge of doing that. So I think we can do that. All I'm suggesting is that when these things are done, it should be done in a way that's reflective of all the people who get them and not just a few. And we need to isolate. We need to do it fairly and prudently, you know. And if we're paying too much, you've got to find a way to get people to come together so that you can reduce it in a way that's fair to all concerned. That's what I think is important.
Please join me in thanking Professor Larry Gersten for his remarks here tonight. I also would like to thank our audiences both here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm John Diaz, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place to be where you're in the know, is adjourned.